Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Edgy Ideas. I'm delighted to announce that this is our 50th episode, and my guest, Leslie Brissett, has just told me that that means it's our Golden Jubilee.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Leslie. We've had over 30,000 listeners. We've had great speakers. You can go and find our backlog. It's a really, really interesting topic. Leslie, it's very good to have you here on our Golden Jubilee. I'm going to invite you to introduce yourself before we get into the theme of today.
Okay. So, as you've said, my name is Leslie Brissett. My role at the moment, I work at the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations in London, where I'm the director of the Group Relations Programme, company secretary, and principal researcher consultant. And I'm a lifelong quester.
You are indeed, and we've known each other for many moons, and you've had a previous episode on identity. Today, though, we're going to focus on a big event happening in UK and being noticed all around the world, which is the death of Queen Elizabeth II. And we thought we'd try and think about this with a curious mind. We've done no preparation for this. We've not planned this. So we're going to have an open conversation and try and draw on psychosystemic thinking, group relations thinking, to think about kind of what the monarchy means and people's responses to it. So where do we begin, Leslie? What's your thoughts?
Well, I suppose the first thought is the amount of ambivalence that has been thrown up by the death of the Queen. So we've had, on the one hand, people who have been staunchly in their position that the monarchy symbolizes something of elitism and is an anathema to a contemporary society. And then on the other hand, we've had people who have been loyalists to the monarchy who are in deep grief about what this means for them personally and what it means for us representationally. And then there's a whole spectrum in between that. So I think that's what struck me, is the difficulty of holding the polarities at this time.
Yeah. I mean, I put a short post on LinkedIn, and it's interesting that I talked about the conflicted kind of experience of being I'm an anti-monarchist. I have questions about the monarchy, have been all my life, really, all my adult life. And yet I really appreciate the Queen as a leader and as a monarch, and 70 years in that role, being thrust into a leadership position at such a young age and holding that role for 70 years, I think is quite an amazing amazing show of leadership. So, you know, there is an ambivalence there, but a lot of people responded saying, thank you, Simon, for sharing that ambivalence, because we can't find anywhere else to express it. It's like you say, people kind of get pulled to one side or the other.
But what does it mean to be an anti-monarchist?
Well, I always felt that the monarchy creates a dependency culture, that it actually gets in the way of people fulfilling their full selves, that it kind of holds a class system and an elite privileged system together. And whilst I appreciate that for many people, my mother included, the monarch was a very important figurehead, that it offers continuity, that offers containment. I value that and appreciate that. And yet I think it creates a dependency culture, which I think is unhelpful.
Yeah, and at the same time, we know that our social institutions, not just the monarchy, are predicated on and built around growing dependency and encouraging a kind of, Gordon Lawrence referred to it as a social passivity, where we can pull people into the dependent state, which reinforces the status quo. So it's in the monarchy, and perhaps you could say it's got its roots in the monarchy, but there's dependencies everywhere. And how and why?
Dependency is everywhere, and in some places it's more so than other places. And I think, you know, in the psychosocial kind of language, there was the famous book From Dependency to Autonomy, was it by Miller and Rice? So, you know, there's always been that move around, how can we maximize people's potential? How can we get solidarity with kind of maximizing equality, people's potential, rather than creating a dependency model where we follow leaders and know our place.
And again, paradoxically, you could argue that the monarch, the ex-monarch, the queen, she demonstrated a capacity to work with authority of other leaders. You know, we hear about the way she took the long view, the way that she held the delicate balance of holding authority on behalf of a constituency. For her, it wasn't, they didn't elect her, but they were her people. And she worked with leaders and executives on how they held their constituencies in mind in a really powerful but subtle way, which shows that as a representation of the monarchy, she was also holding something about holding the people in mind.
She was, and you know, I've moved to Ireland, been here I think a decade, and I'm an Irish citizen, and I've watched the you know, in Ireland it's a republic and they democratically elect a president to hold that kind of role, you know, the apolitical role representing the nation. And they've had some really brilliant presidents. You know, we've had Mary Robinson, Mary McAleese, Michael D. Higgins, and they do a similar thing. And yet I think it's fair to say that there's a difference. You know, when sadly one of those will pass away, there won't be 500 heads of state coming. There'll be sadness and there'll be mourning, but there's something particular about the, is it about the monarchy or is it about Queen Elizabeth's long reign? Probably a bit both, around the power of that role. And I'm wondering what that is, because I mean, my question is if you get rid of the monarchy, then, you know, I think Ireland's not a bad model for a kind of a democratically elected president. It worked quite well. But do you lose some of that kind of stability, that longevity, that containment, that kind of that the role the monarchs do take in the UK? It is a question, I think.
So there's a lot of talk around people who are into the issues of the commons, you know, these free men movements that say actually it's all linked to our relationships to land and land ownership and the feudal history of the UK and our whole legal system. It's enshrined in the very fabric of what we call the state. The nation state is embedded in this idea of land and ownership, which is a really difficult thing to unravel when we look at the whole monarchy system, the Lord's system, all linked to land, all linked to ownership of something that possibly can't really be owned. And I think it's almost such a taken for granted that it becomes possibly unthinkable to think about ourselves as agents without land ownership attached to it.
And what about the wider, I mean, the other critique people have, you know, and I have is, you know, the monarchy and empire, the monarchy and colonialism. We have countries probably going to break away in the next 2 or 3 years. You know, Australia is on the brink, and I think Jamaica and Barbados have strong movements to break away.
Barbados is done.
Is it done already? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They did it. Charles flew over and did the handover.
So there's a, you know, there's questions in the Commonwealth around the legitimacy of the monarchy and how it represents their countries. What's your thoughts on that?
This is where it gets really interesting, because the very leadership, you know, the hierarchies in those nations mirror and replicate the hierarchies within the UK system. So, you know, we have the Queen and she appoints a Governor General, or even the judicial systems are appointed from London. And so many of these Commonwealth, common to who is the wealth, common to, they have been growing fat off the land for themselves. So what we're possibly going to have to question is, do we now then just hand it over to an elite that look like the people that they've been shepherding, or will they actually rethink the taken for granted assumptions about the hierarchies of structures that lead to the social order? And my sense is, when I look at what's happened, we're just changing the faces. But all the systems, all the ways of being, all the ideas are essentially still of the colonial past.
Yeah, and I think this is a challenge. That, you know, my argument would be that the continuing a monarchy kind of system perpetuates that and makes it even harder to undo it and to find a new solidarity amongst the people without a solidarity projected onto the monarch. The Queen had a very, she was hugely admired. One reason my understanding is she was hugely admired was because she was able to absorb all these projections upon her and carry on almost, she wasn't a neutral, but she tried very hard to be uncontentious, tried very hard to withhold her own views on matters. It's quite a particular role, wasn't it, how she took them up?
So you talk about the projection and carrying. You know, she was a container for all of the projections that came her way. And she spoke really eloquently about the container being the role. You know, she talked about the role being the container and then how she occupied the role in her person, I think is what we're observing now in the way that the king spoke about his beloved mama, but also the sovereign. And that tension between person and role and person in role, I think is what we're all having a look at now and possibly have the opportunity to start exploring for ourselves. You know, what are we projecting into these roles of our own, of a broader social authority that allows us to become evacuated in some extent of our own responsibility for what we're creating together? Because it's easy to put it all in the monarchy, you know, it's them, their elitisms, what they're doing, without saying, actually, what's my part in it? And that's a difficult one, because it's not to say that we're not recognizing a social order. But again, I'll go back to Gordon Lawrence when he said it's about managing oneself in role. And that's where we begin to make sense of the social.
Projections go both ways. You know, we idealize and we project all good onto our leaders, and we denigrate and project all bad onto them. It's that inner splitting, isn't it? Things we can't manage inside ourselves, we project onto leaders, and the Queen was an archetypal leader to project upon.
I mean, the first really significant PR role, she was at the helm of all of it. I remember she was part of the first TV broadcast, the first radio broadcasting. She was part of the foundation. I think she was an initial shareholder in Google, even when Google Maps was doing its first outing back in the 90s. She took shares in it. Social innovation, psychic development is kind of intertwined in a very interesting way. And if we think about ideas being interconnected, then the role of the monarchy at some point has to be examined in relation to its role with the Catholic Church, because the monarch as head of and defender of the faith exists in relationship to Catholicism and what was happening in Rome. So the fact that the church itself is currently undergoing its synodal journey under Pope Francis, inviting the whole of the Catholic Union to think about what does it mean to be a church working together synodally, which in group relations terms, we would think about that as collective management, raises interesting questions for the monarchy. Will the Church of England do the same?
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that's a really interesting example. I was, as you know, I was in Rome working on synodal issues with invited by the Jesuits to work with many Catholics from all over the world, representatives on this very issue. And they invited me because of my thinking on eco-leadership, and it's a similar thing. So, you know, Pope Francis is encouraging voices from the margins, unheard voices, lay people, women's voices to participate. So it's a much more participatory shift. And he's using his position to try and open that space up, which I think is very, very interesting. And as you say, the Church of England, I've been working with as well, they are asking those same questions. It's a big question. The question for me is how will this transitional period from matriarch to patriarch, we're going from a female monarch to a male monarch, how will that open up a space where some of that can happen in Britain, beyond Britain, and in the church?
They've done some work around the orders of the inheriting precedence of gender around royalty, haven't they? And I think that Charles may well, he's only got two sons, so he won't have a chance to do anything around daughters and lines of accession. But it's possible that we might be about to encounter a new way of thinking about the role. So, for example, in Africa, there are places in royalty where they have inherited lines, where the king is not necessarily a distinction that's linked to gender. So there are female kings. So I think Charles, in many ways, might represent a challenge to us, because his leadership might be seen to be quite feminine. In fact, if you look at all of his projects that he's been involved with over his years as Prince of Wales, he's been really connected to the land, to issues of equality, to issues of diversity, to issues of gender. He's got lots of very powerful senior women in running his various programs and projects and enterprises. The work around the Duchy of Cornwall, his being the first to go organic, shows a real eco mind. Have you contacted him or his officers to say, look?
No, I'm waiting for the call, Leslie. I'm waiting for the call.
Okay. It will come. It will come.
I don't want to push myself forward. I mean, there's two things interesting there. One is how we think about those things as feminine, and I wonder whether that holds. But two, just thinking about the Queen as matriarch, like, did that change projections, and how was she a mother of the nation? Was she? I mean, Charles tenderly called her Mama. Was she Mama for the nation? And you hear that on the voices of those people in the 30-hour queues to march past her coffin, are using that kind of language as if she was a mother to them, or a grandmother. They often say that.
Well, don't you find whenever you travel around the world, particularly if you go to certain places, you get asked if you've met the Queen? It's a thing in people's minds. I remember when I was
you have a regality which people ask you that.
I was six and I went to America and we were visiting family in New York, and they asked me, everywhere I went, people said, have you met the Queen? I was like, what? No, why would I meet the Queen? And they asked me to draw her, and it was all very odd. But I think it's big in the public mind. I've had messages from people saying, oh, I'm really sorry to hear that your queen has passed. And so there is something about her being projected as the mother of the nation, and that somehow her passing is personal to everybody, not just her blood family.
And I think it is, and it'd be interesting to explore that. I mean, even my own life, you know, my mother was a monarchist pro-queen. She was like a socialist as well, so she held those things together. My father was anti-monarchist in a sense. He thought that it kept people in their place and it didn't kind of help people kind of grow. But every Christmas day, 3 o'clock, we turned on the television and listened to the Queen's speech, and I do it with my family now. It's like, even as a, you know, I respect the voice of the Queen as a thoughtful voice, you know, during kind of the madness of Christmas. That's a time when we sat down together and it became kind of part of the family Christmas ritual, which is interesting. You know, the other interesting thing I've been thinking about is the Queen as coach, thinking about her, listening to all the prime ministers she met once a week. I was, in my young anarchist days, I used to think, why are the prime ministers wasting their time going to drive to Buckingham Palace to, when they should be running the country and they should be doing this and they should be doing that. And now I'm thinking, well, it sounds from their reports from those meetings that she offered a thinking space. She offered a containing space for a very busy prime minister to kind of think differently and in a very confidential way. And she held it on a personal level to the leaders. I think it's a very interesting role as well.
Mm. And I think it also speaks to the authority framework in politics. So it's, and you use the word ritual, which I think is really important to hold on to, that when thinking as we would in a group relations conference, there are rituals and repetitions that create the conditions for a set of containing functions within a conference. In the same way, the monarchy has a set of rituals and repetitions that create a container for the country. So Parliament opens with the Queen's or King's speech. And it's not just a piece of pageantry. I think it's also embedded in the legislative framework that means, you know, she says, my government will follow XYZ program of legislation. And it doesn't become law until she signs it into law. It's a ritual, but it's also a container that is not just symbolic, but also it tells us something about the structures and the fabrics that we're living in and through.
It does tell us something, and it tells us a couple of things, I think. You know, I mean, one thing it tells us is that the monarchy still has a lot of power, even if it's symbolic power. It's also entangled in the wider governance system. So, you know, we have a House of Lords, which is unelected. It's a theocracy in a sense that there's bishops get their places. There's hereditary peers where people get given spaces to govern us without, because they're born into certain families. And then there's appointed representatives from political supporters of different parties. So we have the kind of this entanglement of a system which on the one hand is containing and traditional kind of voices say it's containing. On the other hand, it imposes an undemocratic kind of a hierarchy upon people.
In one hand, yes. But then I think it also exposes the hypocrisy in our systems and our collective denial about recognizing what we are in and what we reproduce in our co-productive states. So, for example, we had lots of debates recently about cash for honours. Do you remember there were people saying, oh, these people are putting money and then they're getting honours? Well, if you look at the honours system, if you follow those lords temporal back through time, they got their lordships through giving cash to kings and queens to kill people. So you put money in so that the king or the queen could raise an army to go and capture something else to add to the Commonwealth. And for your money or your time or your people, if you had enough people that you could offer up, you got a title. So nothing is new. It's always been this way. All honours are because of cash in some way, whether it's hard cash or resource cash or promises. And this is our collective hypocrisy where we get riled up by the media and say, oh, this is terrible. No, it's not. This is the way things are. This is our system.
Well, I would hope that we could change a corrupt system like that. I would hope that when you buy power, that in 2022, that we could actually question that could be part of a transitional questioning that yes, that's been our history, but is that right for the land today, for the people today? And I would say no.
The real gift then becomes, do we have the capacity to imagine another way of doing it? Because most of our imaginations have just been switched off by repetition and ritual. that we're not creatively engaging with the private troubles and the public issues of our time. You know, that's Wright Mills invited us to think about. We don't do it. We just get on the treadmill and go around dealing with the status quo, trying to get more money, to get a bigger mortgage, to buy a bigger house, because we want the trappings of the consumer that has robbed us of our agency, really. We've become consumers of everything. Social media, now people sit feeding on their scrolls rather than actively engaging in their communities. Face-to-face, gritty hands in community gardens. It's become a real pacifying force.
Consumerism has, you know, and yet there is, you know, I met a young person recently who is an activist and, you know, just spending their whole life, you know, that I'm going to be doing a podcast with an animal rights activist soon. That, you know, there's social movements, there's people, there's, you know, there is that kind of a level of consumerism, and there's people who are engaging in trying to do something else. You know, I think it's worth recognizing those, you know, because to be fair, you know, a lot of Prince Charles's work is to recognize those people and encourage those people.
And let's not forget, if you know, I love the whole thing about not losing the historicity of things. Let's look at when Charles was doing what he was doing. Now he's valorized for it. In the beginning, they labeled him a nutcase. They said he's confused. He doesn't understand the science. Because remember, all of our universities and all of our scientists were working for Big Pharma, advocating pesticides, telling farmers that this is the way that you increase productivity and nourish your soil through vertical integration programs that would lead to bigger yields. And Charles, bless him, was saying, no, we need to go wild, we need to diversify, we need to go smaller, and we need to stop using pesticides. And because he was challenging the pockets of people who were funding university chairs and departments and shaping the science, he was pushed out. Likewise, in the medical profession, he spoke really passionately about acupuncture and homeopathy. At a time when people were saying, no, you pump them full of chemicals and you cut them up and you put them into machines. And Charles was saying, no, there are other ways we need to work with energy systems. And he was ridiculed for it. So I think, yes, let's celebrate the activists and recognize that perhaps we're about to have an activist king. And what might that be like as a projective container for all the social movements out there?
Well, I think that's going to be one of his challenges, because when asked if he was going to be an activist king, he said, I'm not that stupid, because he sees the stepping up into that role as having to step back from a previous role, which would be interesting to see whether he does. I mean, the challenge I would put to that, I as an environmentalist and an activist, you know, think Charles did speak out. I wholly agree. I would just say that he doesn't have to speak out from being a part of the firm to hold on all to that kind of wealth, to kind of, you know, that there's like, you can be a symbolic, even if you're a monarchist, you can still be a symbolic head without kind of the other part of it, you know, which is questioned by myself and many others.
So it's, would we rather it went to some of the oligarchs who would own or contain the continuity, if not royalty?
Well, that is a question. As I said, in Ireland, they've got quite an interesting model, and they've elected some very activist people who have taken on the role of presidency and calmed down their political views, but hold a position internationally with others, doing a lot of the role of the monarchs. You know, it is possible. There is possible to kind of have heads of state which are not monarchs and not hereditary and not holding great wealth.
I think it's interesting when you look at Mary Robinson and her role in the elders and that group of people and the whole notion of eldership or elderhood that I know Ruth Silver's been quite active thinking about. How do we conceive of the role of elder in this coming change? And, you know, you and I, Simon, are heading towards being elders, are we not?
Indeed.
Not just not just chronologically, but...
No, it's interesting shift in, you know, one holds an imagination that, you know, I still kind of feel like the young kid on the block, you know, am I legitimate? Do I have a voice? And yet people often look at me as an elder, you know, as a, you know, so you managing that transition in ourselves. And I think the work Mary Robson doing with elders, and I think what the Queen represents, which hasn't been talked about that much, is actually being an elder, you know, being, you know, there's much talked about her, but that kind of, you know, in the UK, there's quite a lot of generational apartheid, isn't there? You know, people get separated into generational groups, and that's a huge loss for the wisdom of the elders.
Asking, what do the elders hold for us? And what do we collectively defend against? If you think about social systems as a defense against anxiety, what's the anxiety in our current social reality that we are all collectively defending against, that perhaps we have to release the monarchy from holding for us? And I think what the monarchs have always done is death. They've done it, and they've done it well. And I think we've all been through the last 3 years up close and personal with the imminence of death through coronavirus, that I think has opened us up to thinking about death in a new way. And I get called into thinking about spirituality and what does it mean to be spirit beings inhabiting human bodies, and that we have a time in this period of time incarnated, but then we at some point let go of the incarnation, let go of the body. And if we do continue beyond the body, then what does that mean? And where do we go? And what's this realm of the ancestors in lots of the traditional systems?
I ran a eco-leadership webinar this week with Michelle McMahon. She's an Aboriginal voice talking about ancestors, talking about community, talking about the country as a worldview and how they're just completely entangled. And it was really, really powerful. It was interesting that people came to listen and they actually got very moved. And it was almost like what she was speaking about, it moved me, almost triggered an unconscious memory from our past. It kind of awakened something in us, which it wasn't like listening to somebody else's story or some other worldview. It was actually something within ourselves. And it was a very powerful kind of awakening to ancestors and the rocks and the trees that speak to us as well, beyond human spirits.
And I think that when we think about what it means to be in a group or what it means to be human, that relationship to the generations ahead and the generations behind also opens up an exploration of that thing of time. Because we take for granted that time is linear with a history and a future. But maybe it's all, like the quantum scientists are telling us, maybe it's all simultaneous. And so our very connection with the here and now of things opens doorways that perhaps there are people living with us who just don't have three-dimensional bodies. What room is there for the non-physical?
Yeah, and I think there is something about the monarchy going back into history. I do think there is something about it does awaken in us a sense of a different sense of time. When I go and stay in a monastery, I'm always very moved by the prayers, and you know, they do their psalms, they do five services a day, And at prayers, they'll often say, "And today we're remembering Brother Michael from who died in 1375." And it's that link to time in a very different way in a monastery than it is from the world I live in on a day-to-day basis, where we're clock watching and running around. And it just takes me into a transcendental kind of place, really. It transcends kind of the time. And I think the kind of historical connections with monarchy is awakens that in people. And I think that's part of what we're seeing as well.
And so how do we respond to that pull? You know, the future, if there is such a thing, if we think about time and its atemporality, how do we engage with the ever-present future that's also the past?
Yes, I mean, I think this this idea of containing spaces, that, you know, the monarchy has clearly been that for many people. For some, it's not been that, and it's been a different force. But I do think this transitionary period for everybody is to think about how we can create containing spaces, because the churches are mostly empty. The Church of England is a very low attendance these days. That used to be another space, again, problematic in the sense it created dependency cultures. But how do we create alive containing spaces where we can actually be alive, where we can create new forms of solidarity, where we can think about the spirit, about time in a different way, where we can listen differently? I think that's what you try and do in group relations conferences.
Yes, Leslie. Because the containing space is apparently outside, but it's also within the individual. And so we become, if you think about the idea of what Eliot Aram talks about, complexity and fractality, then we are fractals of the totality. And so our capacity to contain our own thoughts, our own feelings, and the projections that people put inside us mirrors a capacity in the broader society to contain what's being split off and projected in our social systems. And it's that inability to stay with your phrase, Simon, which I love, staying with the trouble. You know, if we can't stay with the trouble out there in the world, recognizing that the out there in the world is just an imaginal projection of the internal world, we get lost in the boundaries. So we have to stay with the trouble in ourselves.
We do, and I'd love that to be my phrase, but I did borrow it from Donna Haraway just to give her a thank you.
But that's the point, isn't it? You see, we're all borrowing everything. As soon as we're in the realm of language, there is nothing new. Like Ecclesiastes says, there's nothing new under the sun. It's the same old stuff. It's all vanity. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. That's our sweet narcissistic journey.
Leslie, we're coming to the end of this podcast. I ask guests, as you know, what their thoughts are on what it means to live a good life and create a good society. And just reflecting on this particular conversation around the monarchy, these times we're in, what would you draw from that to think about how we live a good life and create a good society?
I think it's inviting us all to recognize the importance of family. You know, our families of origin, despite all that we try to do to the contrary, still holds a real rock around how we locate ourselves in the world. So those images of Harry and Wills walking together, despite all the breakdown that they've had around their wives or their skin colors or the countries they're choosing to live in, family and our relationship to it is really an important gift for us to work with, whatever it means for each of us. We've all got a story with that. And the good society is to how we then extend that feeling to the wider family. That's not family that we share through genetics, but we share through being fellow breathers and walkers on earth. You know, how do we extend that sense of family to everyone? And recognizing when we can't.
Yes, recognizing the lack. Leslie, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you for your thoughts, your wisdom, your time. Go well, my friend.
You too, Captain. All good.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Coming up, we have our next advanced coach program. We now have 400 coaches trained internationally. If you're a coach, a leader, or a consultant wishing to develop your coaching skills, come to this advanced program. It's online for 12 weeks, and I'll be leading that program.